Well, every month we have a speaker. And the speaker presents the theme, and we try to model the music around the theme the best we can. This month, we're very fortunate to have Mr. Dan Barker with it as our speaker. Mr. Barker's career as a teenage evangelist started when he was 15. He received a degree in religion from Azusa Pacific University and was ordained by the Standard Community College in California in 1975. He preached for 19 years and maintained an ongoing musical ministry, including 8 years of full-time cross-country evangelism. A successful musician, having composed over 200 songs that have been published or recorded. And then in 1984, after 5 years of reading outside of Christian sources, Dan announced that he had just simply lost his faith in faith and became a public atheist. Presently, he is co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, together with his wife, Annie Laurie Gaylor. FFRF is based here in Madison. It is the largest organization in the nation advocating for non-theists. Dan co-hosts Free Thought Radio, a national weekly talk show, is a frequent contributor to the FFRF publication Free Thought Today, and has been involved in many lawsuits to help protect our guaranteed separation of church and state. His activities regularly take him around the country and the world, giving lectures, performing concerts, and participating in debates with theists, many of these at colleges and universities. Dan is the author of several books, including Godless, The Good Atheist, Losing Faith in Faith, and a book for young people named Maybe Yes, Maybe No. And his most recent book, and the topic of today's talk, is The Life-Driven Purpose, How an Atheist Finds Meaning. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the strongest voices in atheism in the country today, Mr. Dan Barker.
Thank you, Eric, and good guitar playing. And Peter. Isn't Peter a treasure on the keyboard? That's wonderful. And that's not for singing and all that. Was very nice. And thank you, Naomi. So Peter asked me if I would sing a song. I think it's the song you heard me sing somewhere. The University.
Free Thought Festival.
Let's see if I can get this over here. There's all these songs about God and loving Jesus and all that, and the supernatural, and heaven and hell. But I was reading one of Richard Dawkins' books, Unweaving the Rainbow, I heard him say was his favorite book of all that he's written, where he makes a plea for integrating more science in the arts. Why not bring science and make science accessible, and make science fun, and make science beautiful? So I took the challenge, and I thought, well, why don't I try writing a simple love song that just assumes the fact of evolution without making such a big deal about it? So this one's called It's Only Natural. How do we turn this on here?
Oh, hang on.
Like that? Like the on button?
Or yeah,
like
the on button.
Thanks to Galileo for showing us our humble place in outer space.
Is there a volume on here, too?
Yeah. Left slide.
Where it says volume?
Yeah.
One.
It's very scientific.
Thanks to Galileo for showing us our humble place in outer space. And thanks to Mr. Darwin for showing us the origin of the human race. Which means that our precious romance is mainly the product of chance, and these feelings of love so frenetic are just genetic. It's only natural that I would want you. It's only natural that you want me. A million years of evolution had its way. So we can blame it on our parents' DNA. I move instinctively in your direction. Somehow you signal me to turn and see. You will always be my natural selection. As a voluntary choice, naturally. Sunday Assembly, what a great idea, and what a great bunch of people. I used to be a co-pastor at a different kind of assembly. Years ago, I was an associate pastor at an Assembly of God in California. And that was an experience. Do you know what Assembly of God is? Do any of you know what that is? It's Pentecostal. You know what Pentecostal is?
There's my mother-in-law.
Your mother-in-law is Pentecostal.
That's the end of my sentence.
Oh, your mother-in-law, okay. So, the Assemblies of God, my family was charismatic, if you know what that means. It was kind of speaking in tongues and faith healing and all that. And I accepted a position at the Assembly of God Church, and they were really sweet people. I have to say, they were just really sincere and sweet people. They were coming to church not to learn. They were coming to worship. They were there just to worship and praise God. And I really quickly found them to be a bit, well, more than a bit noisy for my taste, if you know what I mean. All the screaming and then raising hands and faith healing and Jesus and people getting slain in the spirit. And it's an interesting slice of Americana. If you haven't gone to one of those churches, you should probably just sneak in one day. I took Annie Laurie, my wife, in to one down in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I said, you got to see this. And it was a huge mega church where they were all, you know, the big sweaty pastor with a hanky, that whole thing, you know, they're preaching away and hallelujah and speaking in tongues. Ann had already was just sitting there snickering, like looking around, like, what is this? And she finally kind of blurted out, he's got high blood pressure. And people were looking at her, because she was raised with no religion at all. She, you know, she didn't go to church, she didn't care, it was any of that. And whenever she goes to church, she feels like, what is this, kind of like a drama or a play? Or what? Do they really believe this? And it was Dad, when he was a young boy, I think he was 8 or 10, he was in church in southern Missouri with his parents, Methodist church. And he was looking around in church at everybody, and it finally dawned on him, my parents are nuts. They actually believe this. And he was a kid, and he thought that. He was just a kid, and you know, and I think that's pretty cool. When I was his age, I didn't think like that. I wasn't the skeptic. Well, I was sitting there, yes, well, I want to be an obedient child of Christ, and I loved it. You know, I was a full believer in all of that. Why is it? Why is there that difference? Why was I sitting there soaking it up and believing it and getting tears and getting goosebumps and yes? And why did Paul sit there and just start snickering, you know? Which side do you fall on? How many of you were like me when you went to church? You felt it and believed it, right? How many of you were the opposite? You sat there and you looked around wondering, well, you didn't even go. Well, okay. So you sit around wondering, what the heck's happening here? You know, you don't feel, you know, our guest on today's radio show, Len Eisenberg, said he used to go to temple as a kid, and he sat there and he thought, let's get into this, and he saw people just really concentrating and praying. Did you hear a radio show this morning? Anybody? Free Thought Radio. It's on 92.1. And then the guy sitting next to him was like really like deep in prayer, he could tell. But his earplug fell out, his headphone plug fell out, and he could tell he was listening to the World Series game. And he looks like, oh, well, maybe not everybody is really into it. You know, maybe they're just pretending or something. Well, I wasn't. I was a true believer. I was, you know, sometimes Christians tell me, well, Dan, if you really knew God, if you were really a true believer, you would never have left. You know, you ever hear that? You ever hear people tell you that? So I'm not going to tell you my whole story of why I changed my mind, but I wrote a book called Godless. And in the foreword to the book, Richard Dawkins wrote the foreword. And he said, and I still don't know if this is a compliment or not, but Richard Dawkins said, he writes, Dan Barker is the most eloquent witness of internal delusion that I know. Because I believed it. I really, really believed it. I felt it. And I make a case that if I was not a true Christian, then nobody is. And the Bible even says you shall know them by their fruits, not by what they say. And my life was, you know, I lived it and I believed it and I preached it and people came forward and got saved. And I spent years as a missionary and I spent years as a traveling evangelist, hoping that Jesus would delay his return one more day so that we could get more kingdoms, more souls into the kingdom. I was that guy. I was that guy on campus, you know. You know what I'm talking about with the Bible, who was really confident. Dawkins wrote later in the foreword, Dan was not just a preacher. He was the kind of preacher you would not want to sit next to on a bus. That was me. I was that, you know, super confident person. And so I really, really loved it and believed it. And, you know, maybe, I'm not an expert in psychology, but maybe there's a kind of bell curve distribution of personalities. And some of you fall way over here like my father-in-law. You fall like Peter, right? Totally devoid of any spiritual understanding. Totally lost and blind, right? But others like me, I fall way over here on the tail end, just about a half inch shy of hearing voices, you know what I mean? I'm that kind of a person. And I'm still that kind of a person. I can go out, I won't do it today, it's embarrassing. I could still go out behind the barn at night when no one's looking, and I can start speaking in tongues again, and those feelings come back. Oh, and I actually get goosebumps, and I feel this kind of, I don't know how to explain it, like a parental presence in my brain saying, all is fine, all is well, you are my child. I feel that. And some of you know what I'm talking about, right? You felt those things, and some of you don't. So why is it? Why are some of us this way and some of us not? Maybe there was some evolutionary adaptation disadvantage to having that variability within our species. I don't know. Maybe we needed people over here who heard voices who would march to war and do crazy things. I don't know. But it was true, and it was real to me, and I thought, what greater purpose in this brief existence we have on this planet, what greater purpose in life than to be a soldier in the front line of the army of God, to be out winning souls, to be out there preaching. So I preached for 19 years. My first sermon, I was 15 years old down in Mexico, and I stopped preaching at the age of 34 and believed it almost completely all the time, feeling that I was put on this planet for a reason, for a purpose. And then I tell the story in Godless about how I and then my little brother Daryl, also he became an atheist. Of course, he was always kind of a lousy Christian to begin with. I mean, and he even admits it. Daryl even says, my whole attitude toward Christianity was figuring out exactly how much sin can I commit and still get into heaven. You know, it was like, that was his whole approach. Where's that line? You know? And I was his big brother, the preacher, and I always thought he was way over the line, you know. But anyway, when he saw his older brother articulate atheism, and, you know, his older brother was a preacher, left the ministry, then he started saying, yeah, me too, I've thought those things. And so someone else says it out loud and sort of gives you permission to think it yourself, you know. It's like you've been thinking these things, but is it okay for me to have these thoughts? And then someone else comes out and says, I go to Sunday assembly. Oh, well, me too. Well, I've been thinking the same thing. My mom and dad eventually both became atheists as well, which I thought was really surprising. I wasn't trying to preach at mom and dad. I was trying to, like, just, you know, we had a loving family. But my mom eventually just, she said after about 2 years, she says, you know what, Danny's right. You know what, she was teaching Sunday school at an Assembly of God in Mesa, near Mesa, Arizona. She just stopped going. She started reading. And she told a reporter a couple years later, she said, you know what, it's so great being an atheist. I don't have to hate anymore. I don't have to hate anymore. I don't have to decide who's in and who's out. Who are the good people and who are the bad people? Who do we like and who don't we like? She said, we can just all be one family. We can all just be one human species. Isn't that great? And so I'm actually working on a song using those lyrics. I don't have to hate anymore, but they're not close to done yet. But we have a brother, Tom. There's three boys. So I and my brother Daryl and mom and dad both became atheists and happy and outspoken. But Tom is still a born-again Christian. He's still this... he's a great guy. He really is. And I saw him last fall. He's a retired high school principal. And I was in his apartment last fall. And I walked in and there was something weird about his... It was really nice, but there was something weird. I couldn't put my finger on it. What's wrong with Tom's looking around? It's really... He's very clean. I mean, he's a very nice apartment. Then I realized there's no books in here. Have you ever been in a home where there's no books? And it kind of feels like... He had two books. Up on the shelf, above the television, he had the Bible and Purpose Driven Life. Yeah. Those two books. You know, Rick Warren's book, Purpose Driven Life. So today's topic is Life Driven Purpose, which is the reversal. And I wrote the book, Life Driven Purpose, to turn everything upside down. Because I think the believers and the preachers and the theologians have got everything totally upside down. Just like in our country, where we took the whole concept of government, which used to be some sovereign authority, like a monarch, a king, a dictator, a lord, a church, a religion, to be the source of the authority of the country. In the United States, we did this. And we said, we the people. That's the highest authority, we the people. There's no higher authority above. So I think what's happening in religion is that there's this mentality that there has to be some higher authority, some supreme sovereign lord, master, whatever, up above everything to give us our purpose. So I didn't say anything. When Tom and I get together, we know not to talk about religion. We just talk about our family and when we were on the gymnastics team together and we went camping up in the Sierra Nevada, all the fun stuff. And mom's jokes and dad was a police officer. And dad thought mom and us were way too crazy. Anyway, we like talking about family stuff. That's the best thing to do when you get together through family. Why talk about stuff that divides you? Talk about the things that you love and bring you together. So I saw the book on his shelf, Purpose Driven Life, and I kept my mouth shut. Because if we had started talking about that, then you know what would happen. Oh, religious differences. So life-driven purpose is my attempt to turn everything upside down. I think... You know, believers and non-believers, atheists and non-atheists. Where are you, Eric? Atheists and non-atheists. You said non-atheists when you meant non-theists, right?
I sure did.
It's all right. You'll probably count all the things I say wrong the other two. So
we're welcoming to believers and
exactly. So I think we're all looking at the same world, right? We are all biological organisms made of the same stuff, and we're looking at the same world. But I think if you have the telescope pointed the wrong way, you're looking through the same instrument, but what are you going to see if you're looking through the wrong end? You're going to see something, right? You need to turn it all the way around 180. So life-driven purpose is my attempt to turn everything around 180 and flip the whole thing upside down. So, in fact, the Secular Student Alliance, which is a national organization of free thought clubs, humanists, atheists, agnostics, all over the country, they're trying to arrange a debate between me and Rick Warren. Rick Warren is that big megachurch pastor. He wrote The Purpose-Driven Life. He gave the opening prayer at Obama's first inauguration, if you remember. So he's a big name. He's big in the evangelical community. And his book, Purpose-Driven Life, has sold tens of millions of copies all over the world, and many reprints and spin-offs of it. So he may not agree, but wouldn't that be a cool event to actually have a purpose-driven life versus life-driven purpose debate about the whole idea? So I think, and 4 years ago, a publisher wanted the book, but then they got cold feet. Ulysses Press, I presented to them, let's do a book called Life-Driven Purpose. They were afraid that if we called it Life-Driven Purpose, that Rick Warren would sue them. Rick Warren's book, Purpose-Driven Life, is actually trademarked. Have you ever seen a book title that's trademarked? Because you can't copyright a book title. But he trademarked his book title so no one else can use it. So the publisher, Ulysses, was kind of afraid. You know, he's litigious, he sues, and I'll tell you about a lawsuit he took. So they didn't want to call it Life-Driven Purpose, and in fact, they took all the guts out of it. They were afraid that if I came out with a book like that, that that would get them in trouble. In fact, they even put in the back of the book, they call it, instead of Life-Driven Purpose, they call it The Good Atheist. They made a nice book. The Good Atheist is a nice book. It's about the good things that atheists have done for the world. But it wasn't the book I wanted. I wanted Life-Driven Purpose. So last year, Pitchstone Press said, we'd like to do it. They were not afraid. Pitchstone Press is a new publisher in North Carolina. And I said, you're not afraid if we have call a book Life-Driven Purpose that Rick Warren might sue you? And the publisher basically said, bring it on. Wouldn't that be great publicity? I mean, wouldn't that be cool? That's kind of like what happened with Al Franken in Fox News. Remember that? They sued him and he won. It was a big, he sold a lot of books because of that. So please, Rick Warren, sue us. So they came out with a book and they decided to wait a few months because their whole plan, and I think this is kind of interesting, is to have the very first book written by an atheist on the inspirational bookshelves. Have you ever gone to the airport and you see these kind of stacks of Joel Osteen, Seven Steps to Meaning, you know, all these books that are trying to tell you how to live your life and conduct of life and find your true purpose and Rick Warren, all that, all these kind of psycho crap faith books that are selling hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies. Has there ever been one written by an atheist on the inspirational bookshelves? And I know what you're thinking. The word inspirational means
religious.
Yeah, like religious, right? Well, I'm trying to turn that upside down. I think we non-believers are truly inspired, and believers are outspired. They have to get it from outside themselves, from above themselves up there, coming down to them. Somebody giving them their marching orders or giving them their purpose in life. In fact, that's exactly what Rick Warren says in his book. The very first sentence of Rick Warren's book is, "It's not about you." So guess what's the first sentence in my book?
It's about you.
It is about you. When it comes to purpose, not everything, you know, morality and truth and all that, those are independent of your opinions, but purpose. Purpose is personal, and purpose can't not be about you. Purpose is how you choose to live your life. So I think instead of having outspired somebody giving you, tell me what I should do, that we natural human beings who are non-believers are truly inspired, if we can twist the word around a little bit, or maybe inspired is a better way of saying it. So why shouldn't non-believers also have what you would call inspirational thoughts? So the first chapter of Life-Driven Purpose is kind of written in that kind of, it's not really mimicking, but it's kind of gently in that same kind of here's some advice for living. You know, and I can get away with it because I used to be a pastor, so I can kind of make a little joke about it. I used to be a minister, so here I'm going to give you some advice. I don't like to be preachy, but in this case, that first chapter is a bit, here's what you should think and here's how you should go, so that it would belong on those inspirational shelves. The rest of the book, I go back to my normal voice and my normal irritating self, so you can... I talk about morality, I talk about can something come from nothing, and I have a chapter that explains kind of my take on what's wrong with the mind of the fundamentalist. So it's called Religious Color Blindness. Rick Warren came to our attention back in the late 1990s when he sued the IRS. There's a provision in the tax code, and you may not know this, that allows ministers of the gospel to exclude their housing from income. It's called the housing allowance or the housing exclusion. And ministers of the gospel, it says, the actual words are ministers of the gospel, but the IRS considers any clergy, including rabbis, to be ministers of the gospel. Figure that out. But anyway, any clergy in the country who gets an income from conducting sacerdotal functions, like a minister, priest, rabbi, even cantors in a temple, they don't have to report their housing as income. So wouldn't you love to do that every year? Wouldn't you love when you're doing your taxes to say, oh, my house payment and my rent isn't income? That drastically lowers your tax liability, right? So you would pay a lot less taxes. That's a special break that our country in the 1950s has given to this higher class of people. In a country where we're all supposed to be equal, there's a certain upper class of people called the clergy who get some special breaks. It kind of harkens back to the days of theocracy, right? When the churches and the priests were sort of up there with the king and the queen or whatever, they were sort of part of a higher level. Here in the country where we call our president Mr. President, we don't consider the president a higher class of person, but the clergy are still claiming that they get to be kind of a special class. What happened was Rick Warren was declaring, he got his church to designate that his entire salary was a housing allowance. All of it. So he reported zero income, which is obviously cheating, right? Because he wasn't spending all of his income on housing. But the tax code at the time was kind of ambiguous, and it didn't specify a limit. It just said a housing allowance, right? If your church gives you a housing allowance. And so the IRS made a determination that he was breaking the law. The IRS penalized him. The IRS went after Rick Warren, and guess what he did? He sued the IRS. He said, it doesn't say I have to limit it to a certain amount. So it's Warren versus the Tax Commission. And the case was mooted because Congress stepped in to change the wording to clarify that from now on the housing allowance has to be limited to the fair rental value of your home. You can't charge more than you're actually spending, right? And they got him off the hook. It was grandfathered in. He didn't have to pay back penalties or anything like that. Congress basically saved his butt. You know, Congress came in for Rick Warren. They changed the law. So from then on, the housing allowance is slightly different, and nobody can technically cheat, although I'm sure a lot of them are. A lot of churches are deciding, well, let's just ordain everybody. And like Pat Robertson's organization, let's ordain the janitor. The basketball coach at a Catholic high school is considered a member of the clergy. So they get this break. You can see all the potential for abuse, which is one of the cases that the Freedom from Religion Foundation is pursuing. We sued and we got a positive decision in federal court, and then the appeals court overturned it on standing. So we're dropping back and we're reformulating it. But there was actually a strong decision saying that that's unconstitutional. You can't give special breaks to clergy that no one else gets. So Rick Warren has a congregation of people who might have a purpose-driven life, but their pastor has a loophole-driven life. Pastors think they are somebody special, that they have this ability. Have any of you read his book, Purpose-Driven Life? No? Good. No, don't admit it.
Bill Maher made fun of it. It's a great YouTube
video. Oh, he did? Yeah, he does read parts of it, yeah. It's like a 40-day thing. You read a chapter for each day of a 40-day kind of thing. And apparently, since it rained for 40 days in the ark and Jesus was 40 days in the wilderness, something about 40 days just makes it really special. Well, if you read The Purpose-Driven Life, and maybe I'll save you the trouble. Do you want to know what the purpose of life is according to Rick Warren?
Yes.
Okay, here it is in less than a minute. It is to know God. It is to glorify God. It is to assemble with other people who also believe in God and to get others to join you. Plus a few little extra things like doing good works and that. But basically, that's the purpose of life. That's why you were placed on this planet. You don't get to choose that. It's not about you. You were placed here for His purpose. So I think that's totally upside down and totally backwards. I think that asking if there's no God, what is the purpose of life, is like asking if there's no master, whose slave will I be? I gotta be somebody's slave. I gotta have somebody up there telling me I have to fit into this something up there that I know that I where I belong. And wouldn't we all kind of, well, maybe not all of us, but a lot of people on this planet would like to know, what is my point? What is my purpose? Why am I here? And I used to preach that when you didn't know it, but it was your lucky day when God directed you to sit next to me on that bus. Because everything had a plan. It wasn't accidental. You didn't realize it, but when you saw me and you saw the message that I had, you were going to be touched by it. And I would talk to you for a while and, oh, hello, how are you? I knew that it wasn't accidental. It wasn't random. It was planned by God for you to be sitting next to me. So excuse me for saying this, but I can tell that you are really going through some real struggles in your life right now, aren't you? How does He know? And you're having a real problem with some personal relationship in your life now. I'm pretty sure, aren't you? Yes, yes. How does He know that? And you know, that's okay. I used to be just like you. I used to wonder, why am I here? What's the meaning? How do I know what's right and wrong? What's my future going to be like? What's it all? Why was I placed on this planet? Well, there's an answer, and that answer is Jesus. So probably nobody in this room is gullible like that person I was talking to, but an awful lot of people are. An awful lot of people in this world, they want somebody who has confidence and answers. They want someone, a minister or a priest or a higher level of person, to be able to hand to them, here's the answer. Here's what you must do. And a lot of people follow it. There's got to be some tendency within at least half of the species. I don't know how you would delineate it, but on this side of the bell curve, there's got to be a whole bunch of people who feel lost and empty, and they want guidance. They want someone else to think for them. They want it top down, right? They want it to be outspired. Because otherwise, how do you explain the success of these religious movements? Religious movements all through history, you know, the Millerites and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the... How do you explain the Mormons? The Mormons went over to England, and they went up to people, and they spoke to them about the gold tablets and the little little rocks, and Joseph Smith got the Book of Mormon from the Angel Moroni, all this stuff, and this New York State. And then the people over there were listening, and then they would say, okay. And some of them came back to Utah with them. Why would someone do that? How do you explain that there are people on this planet who would be so easily susceptible to whatever you want to call it, mysticism or, you know. Maybe they don't feel like they know where they fit in or what their purpose is. They're wanting someone outside of them to give them. I think purpose, and I think Rick Warren and William Lane Craig and other writers confuse the word purpose, because the word purpose has two different meanings. And you can read it in their books. They're using it in one meaning and then they flip. It's called equivocating. They'll flip it to a different meaning. Purpose really has two different meanings. The basic meaning is inside of a living organism. Why did the roots of a tree reach to the river? Why? It needs something. It wants something. It's got a goal. It's trying to either get something or it's trying to avoid the problem. A living organism possesses internal purpose when it has a goal that it's trying to accomplish. It could be to find food, to avoid predation. It could be to find a mate. It can be to lessen threats, shelter, whatever. There's thousands, you can think of a thousand things that we would need as biological animals in a natural environment that has a lot of threats to it and challenges. And as we try to meet those, it's called purpose. We're aiming for that target. We're trying to reach that goal. And when you look at another thing, a bird or a cat or some other, you look at it and you think, well, it's got some intentions within it, right? It's trying to do, trying to feed, hide its acorns, or it's trying to, you know, whatever we do to continue living. But there's another usage of the word purpose, which is a secondary usage. And I think this is where these pastors trade and they flip it. And that is when we assign the intentions of the designer of a tool, we assign it to the tool itself. Like when you ask, what's the purpose of a hammer? You're not imagining that the hammer has any internal intentions. You don't think, hey, hammer, what are you doing? You don't think of that, right? What you're actually asking is what was in the mind of the person who's using it or designed it. And then you take that word purpose and put it onto the tool. And I think most religions, not all of them, but I think most religions treat human beings as if we were tools or implements, as if we were lifeless. And even the Bible says that. You have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power may be of God and not of us. And I must die to Christ so he can live through me. So in most religions, the human beings are just these lifeless tools that need to be animated from some spark outside of them. And then that gets like a Frankenstein, you know, we're just this nothing of a thing. And then somehow this spirit spark comes onto us. Well, now we get to march and do what this leader tells us to do. So it flips. I don't think any of them, so far as I read, have actually defined the word purpose for what we actually mean by the word purpose. So I think, in the case I make in Life Driven Purpose, I think it is we non-believers, whatever you call yourself, atheist or agnostic or secular humanist or natural deist or whatever you call yourself, at the Freedom from Religion Foundation, we don't care what people call themselves. What we like to say is that we all disbelieve in the same God. So, whatever you call yourself, I think we non-believers have the truly good news to offer the world. Not the good news that you have to bow down before this son of this God who shed his blood for you because God was so angry that his blood had to be shed. You know, this whole message of John 3:16 and all that. I think the good news, truly good news we offer to the world is going to sound counterintuitive or maybe even sound wrong on its face when I say it. But it is really great news that I think we should trumpet wherever we go. And it is this. There is no purpose of life. That kind of sounds wrong, doesn't it? But actually, it's good that there's no purpose of life. We shouldn't want there to be a purpose of life, because if there were, we would be secondary, obligated to that purpose of life. We would be members of an army or slave under a plantation owner or whatever. We would be secondary in some way to have this purpose of our life for which we were created put on us. Of course, life is survival and reproduction, but that's not the purpose of life. That's the definition of life. Life is defined as reproduction and survival. That's what we mean by it, and other things as well. So it's great news to say and to acknowledge that there's no purpose of life because life is its own reward. If there's a God, is God sitting up there wherever thinking, why am I here? What is my purpose? Why is there a God instead of no God? What is it all about? How do I find my meaning? How do I decide? If there's a God, is that God doing the same thing? If a God can just be allowed to exist on its own, and I'm not saying it does, but if it does exist, if it can be allowed to just be what it is, without any external justification above it, then why can't we? We are also living organisms that evolved. We know where we came from. Why can't we just say life is life? Our life is its own reward, and we have it once, and we can enjoy it as it is. But, let me take a copy here. But, and this is crucial, To say there's no purpose of life is not to say there's no purpose in life. There's immense purpose in our lives. We can have purpose-filled lives even better than following orders from some master. We can lead lives of immense purpose and meaning and goals. Who would dare suggest that Elizabeth Cady Stanton led a purposeless life? She was an atheist. She worked for half a century for this crazy idea that women should be able to participate in their own democracy. She cared so much about it. She cared about this world, about this life. She didn't care about the Bible. In fact, she always railed against the Bible. If you read her stuff, she could hardly say anything without criticizing the Bible. She said the Bible and the church are the greatest stumbling blocks in the way of women's emancipation. They're getting in the way. And it was always the church and the priests and the ministers who were fighting equality for women. So, in fact, she once wrote an article for a bicycling magazine. And she couldn't resist criticizing the Bible in that, you know. I guess because, you know, women had to ride side saddle or something about women, you know. The way women dressed, that society had to tell women how they should dress. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton and other people that you can imagine, Margaret Sanger and philosophers, Bertrand Russell and scientists and science popularizers, Carl Sagan and you name it, songwriters and poets and authors and architects, people who do not believe in a God and yet have immensely enriched the world because they live lives of purpose. So, if there's no purpose of life, there's no outspired, top-down model of our purposes, but there's purpose in life, a bottom-up kind of a thing, how do you find it? Where does it come from? How do you know what that is? Well, luckily, no one tells you. There's no atheist pastor to come along and hand out to you your purpose. I mean, you wouldn't want there to be. In fact, if there were, everybody would run away, right? Who are you to tell me what my purpose in life is? Usually, you don't find your purpose. You can. Like the first couple years of college is called liberal arts, and you're kind of tasting and sampling, and maybe you'll find a major that you say, oh, this is great, I like this instead of that. But usually, you don't find your purpose. Usually, it finds you. If you're avoiding a predator, if there's a disease, if, you know, what something that comes up in your life that gives you some motivation to either go towards or away from something, there's your purpose. So perhaps one of your siblings or one of your parents dies of a horrible, rare disease, and you say, I'm going to fight that disease. You weren't placed on this planet for that, but you decided, I'm going to choose to do that. I'm going to choose to fight this or to do that, to dedicate my life to that. So purpose comes from solving problems. And problems, whatever they are, and you could probably list 1,000 different kinds of problems that happen to our lives, whatever the problem is, it's natural. It's a material, natural thing. And its avoidance, therefore, is a natural exercise. You're involved in gaining knowledge. And problems don't have to be negative. Problems can also be positive. Like the problems of solving a mathematical problem or a scientific problem or creating art. Whatever, because they all have their challenges, whatever you're doing, whatever you're choosing. So we all can live immense lives of purpose with life-driven purpose, which is bottom-up rather than purpose-driven life. Now, I'm going to stop now because, what is it, almost four? And I could preach forever. preachers, I like to remind people that the word reverend was a typo. Did you know that? The first letter was originally N. By the way, I see Ingrid here. Ingrid Lass is the photographer of the cover of the book. So, if you like the cover, Ingrid took the picture right here at the, where was it? It was at the Humanities Building, right? Yeah, so she followed me around one day and she took a bunch of shots and they liked that one. So, and she's available for weddings and whatever and all that kind of stuff. What else did you want me to say? Just kidding. So should I end with a song and then we do questions? Do we have enough time to do that? All right. Okay, I love doing this song. This is the song that I got to write with Charles Strauss, who's the Broadway composer, who wrote Annie and Bye Bye Birdie and all that, you know? He talked at one of our conventions, and we had him on the radio show, and he said, hey, let's write a song together. So we did, which is really cool. And who would say that someone like him did not have purpose in his life, right? He's in his 80s now, and he's a lifelong atheist, and he used to work with Butterfly McQueen, who, by the way, was also a lifelong atheist. She was a life member of our organization. The actress who played the little maid in Gone with the Wind, remember her?
I don't know nothing about birth and no babies, Miss Scarlett.
And she was upset because they always gave her these stupid maid roles. And she's a brilliant woman, just really smart. You can tell in her eyes. So Charles Strauss and Butterfly McQueen used to tour together and for civil rights and that. When he was young, he was a young pianist. And so he just cared about life. And he later said, I didn't know there were so many atheists in the world, too. He didn't know that Richard Rodgers, the songwriter, was an atheist. Or that Cole Porter. Cole Porter had to come out of two closets. The Gershwin brothers and Irving Berlin, who was an agnostic humanist who didn't believe in God, but he wrote God Bless America. Not for himself, but for a character in the musical. So Charles Strauss is part of that proud tradition of creative people who don't believe in a God, but really love making the world a better place. So I sent him these lyrics, and he set them to music. It's called Poor Little Me. The multitudes mumble mythologies without end, but me, I have trouble with ologies that pretend to show what can't be shown, to know what can't be known. Lutherans have liturgies, Calvinists have creeds, Muslims have their minarets, Catholics have their beads, Methodists have methods, holy truth to ascertain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. Bishops transubstantiate, Shintos ring their bells, Transcendentalists meditate while Wiccans weave their spells. Hindus chant a mantra when they can't relieve the pain, but poor little me, I only have a brain. So fearful of the Netherlands, believers band together, unhappy with the weatherman, the Zunis wave a feather. They dance in circles to demand the great spirit send some rain, but what do you do if you only have a brain? Quakers quake, Shakers shake, and Jews eat kosher food. Rastafarians wear their hair in pious gratitude. They all boast of miracles that no one can explain, but poor little me, I only have a brain.
Brain.
You've probably heard about the Clergy Project.
Right.
The Clergy Project, which started in March of 2011. Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, the philosopher. Daniel Dennett, by the way, wrote the foreword to Life Driven Purpose. And it's an audiobook now, so you can hear Dan Dennett read the foreword, which is kind of fun. And then I and Linda LaScola and Elizabeth Cornwell, we started the Clergy Project in 2011 with 52 people, mostly former clergy like me. Today there's more than 600, about 650 clergy, about a quarter of whom are still in the pulpit, believe it or not. About 150 of them are still preaching and they want to get out. They know it's phony, but they're stuck. And some of them can't wait to find another job. So we've raised some money to help retrain some of those clergy to find some honest work, you know, to get out into the world. And it's tough because what do? You have a divinity degree and you've spent 20 years preaching, and so what kind of a job are you going to find? One good fit is teaching philosophy. Some of them do that. Another one is social work. There's a former Mississippi Roman Catholic priest right here in Madison, Tom Reed, who went into the Catholic priesthood because he wanted to help people, and he left for the same reason. And he got married and he's been a social worker, so that's a good skill.
Marketing,
yeah, sales. And a nonprofit. Going out of church into nonprofit work has been a very good transition. In fact, some of the nonprofits are religious nonprofits, so the minister can kind of ease out without telling the community that I've totally become an atheist. They can still work. A fellow in North Carolina did that. So there's an awful lot who are phonies, but I happen to think, and Annie Leroy disagrees with me, I happen to think most of them are sincere. I happen to think, in spite of what Billy Graham said, I think he's sincere. I think he's sincerely deluded, but he's sincere about it, just like I was. I thought, I really believed, you know. And it wasn't until later when I started having questions. So I don't know how to answer what percentage are fakes and what aren't. We know some are actual fakes. Peter Popoff with his hearing aid that's getting, you know, he's getting messages from God, but it's really his wife in the back room, you know, feeding him this stuff.
Some would say same difference.
Same difference? Okay. Yeah. That's a good joke. You're right, it's a gig. But if the gig were all that important, why are so many of us leaving it? Why are we getting out of it? So I wish somebody could find a way to estimate or quantify what percentage of them are sincere and what aren't. Or maybe it's a mixture. You know, I remember for 4 or 5 months, I was a horrible hypocrite. I was an atheist in the summer of 83, but I didn't stop preaching until December of that year. And I would get up in the pulpit, and I was saying things I didn't believe anymore, and I hated myself, but people were still coming down to get saved. People were still getting blessed. And it was obviously showmanship, and it was like, I'm ashamed that I didn't stop right away, but it was kind of interesting to see what happened, because after one of my sermons, where I was inwardly just totally like, this is wrong, I shouldn't be, this is not fair to me, and it's not fair to them, a woman came up and she said, Reverend Barker, I want you to know I really felt the Spirit of God on your ministry tonight. And I was thinking, you did? So that tells you the game or the drama that's being played. The ministers up here and the people in there, so they're going along with this whole thing. So I was kind of trapped in this mechanical thing, and I could say all the words and I knew what to say and the people would clap and praise God and all that. So a lot of them are probably kind of feeling kind of like, what else can I do with my life? So, yeah, it is unfair. It's because it's the status quo. The status
right.
quo has the advantage. It's sort of this privilege that they have, and when you and I speak up differently, I'm not saying we shouldn't speak up. My brother knows exactly what I think, right? So I mean that we're past that point of letting each other know, at minimum, and I'm not an advice columnist or anything for that, but at minimum, I would think we should at least let it be known that we disagree. You don't have to get into a long drawn out argument. You don't have to argue moral philosophy or evidence for the resurrection. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You can just at least, and you know, sometimes you can protest too much. Sometimes atheists come across too strong, like they're insecure that everybody doesn't think like them, right? So that kind of betrays a kind of, if you're happy and moral and a loving person, that speaks a lot, and you can say, I don't agree with you, no, what's for dessert? You know, that kind of thing. But every family is different. My family was surprisingly open, and, you know, and we a true love is going to weather that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're afraid of not being able to weather a difference like that, how much real love is there? Is it phony? Is it just for appearances or what? I tell you, it's a great way to test who your friends are. To tell them all that you don't believe anymore. I lost a bunch of friends, but did I really lose anything? If the friendship is contingent upon you belonging to the same group, you know, you have to think like me or you're not my friend. Well, then is that a real friendship? Because what happens when that external thing breaks? Then are they really friends? I was surprised how some of them are still good friends today. Some of my Christian, devout, conservative friends and relatives, we're still friends today because we like each other as people. There's a real underlying biological friendship that's real, that we actually really like each other. But I discovered how much of that was phony and that they're gone. And so I guess I didn't lose anything. And it might be painful to lose friends and family opinion, but what have you lost if you don't have that kind of openness? Thank you.
Thank you.